WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. At 10:26 local time this morning in Baghdad, former coalition administrator Paul Bremer gave interim Prime Minister Ayad Alawi a leather-bound transfer document in a surprise ceremony, lasting just a few minutes. Bremer's words were brief and to the point.
Coalition Provisional Authority will cease to exist on June 28th, at which point the occupation will end and the Iraqi interim government will assume and exercise full sovereign authority on behalf of the Iraqi people.
The signed transfer document gave political authority to the interim Iraqi government. 2 hours after the official handover, Bremer left Baghdad on a military transport plane. The U.S. occupation administration had ended, without ceremony or fanfare, 2 days ahead of schedule. But for many Iraqis, the handover is largely symbolic. U.S. troops will remain in the country, and the interim Iraqi government will continue to operate much as it did before the handover today. Tonight on Point, U.S. transfers sovereignty to Iraq, what it means for Iraqis, their government, and their future. We begin in Baghdad with one of the members of the Iraq interim government, National Security Advisor Dr. Muwaffaq al-Rubai. I asked him why the handover came 2 days early.
We felt much more confident than we didn't need Jerry Bremer anymore. He handed over the last file yesterday, and we felt that there is no point in him staying. We said, well, thank you very much, good luck, go back home.
Was there a thought, though, that maybe you were trying to avoid or avert planned attacks for June the 30th?
Well, terrorism has been with us for a few months, and it's going to stay with us for the next few months as well. I don't think we should time our political process to suit the terrorists. This is one thing that they will definitely fail to do, to derail the political process or to force us to reschedule our dates of sovereignty according to the Terrorist Act.
But what's actually changed in Iraq today with Ambassador Paul Bremer handing over legal authority to Iraq's Chief Justice, Medhat Mahmoud?
It's a great day in Iraq. Can you imagine a country of 35 years tyranny and 14 months of occupation? Now the sovereignty is in the heart of Iraqis. We decide our fate today, and we feel that we will be much more effective than the coalition in dealing with the terrorists, because we're going to be much more robust, and we're going to use a preemptive strikes against these terrorists. We're not going to wait in Baghdad and let them come and plan and attack our people. We're going to chase them to their homeland, to their hideouts.
Even though you are a sovereign government still reliant on some 150,000 foreign troops for security?
Well, that's not true, Julian. I'll tell you what, the Iraqi policemen and the Iraqi new Iraqi army and the counter-terrorist force and the National Defense Force are now approaching to full dependence on themselves. We will need the multinational forces as a backup over the horizon. And in a few months' time, we may probably not need them anymore.
But who's going to enforce martial law, for instance, if that is introduced, as the Prime Minister Ayad Alawi has been hinting?
Well, I don't think the Prime Minister Alawi is going to declare martial law. Well, we're not talking about emergency law or martial law. We're talking about what we call a law for defense of public safety. This will allow the government, without violating the transitional administrative law, without violating the Article 2 of our mini-constitution, which is the Bill of Rights and the human rights and democratic values, without violating any of these, we are going to use some measures, exceptional measures, for curfews, but all within the legal framework of the new Iraq. The moment we are pushed by the terrorists to violate the human rights, then they are successful and we are defeated.
But in the coming days, in the coming weeks, what can we expect to change in Iraq because of this handover?
The psychology is sky high now. The people are thrilled and they are so happy. and the morale against the terrorism and against Saddam loyalists is sky high. And that's why people are going to take this as an assault and attack by the terrorists against the Iraqi people. So it's now Iraqi people waiting for democracy, waiting for prosperity, versus terrorism who want destruction and death and the regression and bringing the past of Taliban-style regime in Afghanistan to Iraq.
Dr. El-Rabai, you talk about sky-high morale now amongst Iraqis, but how do you measure that? Even the handover ceremony was conducted behind closed doors.
Well, I'm not denying there is a security issue here, but look at the people saying in the street, in the markets. People are celebrating. People are dancing as well and singing. People are showing, expressing their views over the television stations and the radio. Although they are expecting a lot from this Iraqi interim government, they wanted this Iraqi government to really be robust and firm with the terrorists.
So how should we measure the success of this government now?
There are four fronts here. Number one is security and the number of terrorist operations against the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people. Number two is the economy and the standard of living of Iraqis and their personal income. Number three is the progress in the election process. And number four is preserving and maintaining the infrastructure, the oil pipelines, the electricity grids, and also providing the service to the ordinary people. These are the four parameters we can measure the success of this government with.
And you are committed, are you, to the holding of elections next January? Because, again, the Prime Minister, Ayed Alawi, has indicated there might be a bit of slippage there.
I don't think he has indicated there might be a delay in the election. If we delay the election for one day after the 31st of January next year, we're doomed to fail. And it means that the terrorists will declare victory on us. The 31st of January next year is a sacred day. Before that day, we have to have a general election and we should have a transitional National Assembly before then.
Dr. Muwaffaq Al-Rubai is National Security Advisor for the Iraq Interim Government. He spoke to us from Baghdad. Just hours after former coalition administrator Paul Bremer left the country, members of interim Prime Minister Ayed Alawi's government were formally sworn in. The proceedings began with an Islamic prayer. One by one, members of the interim Iraqi government stepped forward, placed their right hand on the Quran and pledged to serve with sincerity and impartiality. Meanwhile, on the streets, many ordinary Iraqis were taking a realist view of the situation in Iraq, looking at security and stability in the country as key concerns. Tanasi Kambanis is correspondent for the Boston Globe. I asked him how the Iraqis he spoke to today in Baghdad were reacting to the news of the transfer of sovereignty.
What people on the street were talking about today, where I was, wasn't the transfer of sovereignty, but a very impressive crackdown on criminal gangs the day before. This was in the thieves market in central Baghdad, and yesterday the interior minister himself led a platoon of police commandos into the neighborhood where they basically pistol whipped a bunch of suspected carjackers, loaded them into police vans, and made a point of showing the residents of this criminally infested neighborhood that there was a new sheriff in town. A day later, this is what everyone was talking about. The transfer of sovereignty to them was an afterthought, and they were just expressing a lot of hope that they'd see some tough behavior from the new government like what they saw on Sunday.
So there is an expectation among Iraqis that this new government is now going to get tough on crime, tough on terrorism?
Yes, and I think that what we have to beware of a little bit is the same kind of unrealistic expectations that followed the occupation last year. When Saddam's government fell, there was this immediate wave of optimism that washed over people for a few weeks. And when the U.S. couldn't restore the power grid instantly or take control of the streets instantly, they quickly were embittered. Now, I'm feeling a little bit of the same sense where people are saying things that I'm not sure are going to turn out to be, where they look at a raid like Sunday's and they say, with Iraqis in charge, they will be able to be terrorists. They will be able to be criminals because we know our own people, and the Iraqi police are going to be able to patrol the streets in a way the U.S. Army never could. And while there is some reason to believe that can happen, I think there's also a lot of reason to be afraid that they'll find that this undertrained police force will succeed in some places but not in others, that this government, while competent in many ways, will encounter some of the same frustrations that the occupation authority did. And if that happens, the shattered expectations could lead to a new wave of anger, resentment, and perhaps even destabilizing violence.
Members of the new government seem to be putting an awful lot of hope in the ability of the emerging Iraqi security forces. But what progress has been made in training that force?
Frankly, not much more since last April, when all three Iraqi security forces, the police, the Civil Defense Corps, and the Army, collapsed in the face of twin uprisings. Since then, a lot of folks have admitted that training wasn't working out. So at this point, if you actually stacked up what's now called the Iraqi National Guard, the new Iraqi Army, and the Iraqi Police Force, you'd find that they're now almost back up to the staffing levels that they were at the beginning of April. You'll see in the statements of the new Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi, a lot of tough talk about what he hopes to do, but when you read the fine print, he's talking about reconstituting the Army over a period of several months. He uses the future tense a lot. He talks about coming up with new commando units of the police that are going to be able to do counterterrorism and stop car bombs and infiltrate carjacking and kidnap gangs. He does not say, this is something we're ready to do tomorrow. And frankly, as one person put it, if it takes a woman 9 months to have a baby, it doesn't take nine women 1 month to have a baby. And what he was trying to say is that no matter how much money and how many people you plunge into training programs, it takes 6 months to a year to produce a quality soldier or a quality police officer. And those realistic time constraints are going to hamper anybody who's in charge of this effort.
Security, then, is at the top of a lot of Iraqis' agenda. But what are their other expectations? What are they expecting this post-handover government to be able to deliver on?
Well, some people say everything. The number one concern is safety on the streets. Number two is electricity, especially until September, when temperatures are going to be above 100 degrees every day, and people are very aware of when their air conditioners are on and when they're off. So getting the power system working. And then the next one is ending the kidnapping and the carjacking, which are still endemic. I think at that point, if those three major problems are solved, people will go to the other list, which is garbage on the streets, uncontrollable traffic, bad municipal services.
This new government seems to believe that because sovereignty has been transferred, there's going to be a greater willingness on the part of Iraqis to pass on intelligence, that the fight against the Islamic militants is going to become a lot easier because of that. Have you had any sense of that?
It surprised me, actually, but people I talk to on the streets are suddenly more willing to express anger at the terrorists who are behind these attacks on the Iraqi people. And these are the same folks who 3 weeks ago, after a car bombing, would say that perhaps this was an American bomb, not a suicide bomber, or any sorts of untenable conspiracy theories. And suddenly they are openly angry at what they see as outside forces out to destabilize their country. And if the new government can channel that and get people to come in and inform the police, to get people to identify potential terrorist insurgents in their midst, I think the main place where we'll see a change is that the new government can crack down forcefully in ways that the occupation forces never could. If this new government has intelligence saying that a place is a suspected terrorist house, they can go in and raid it, perhaps on dubious legal grounds, and that will actually be perceived as a popular, tough move rather than as an abuse of power by an outside occupation force.
Tanasi Kambanis is Baghdad correspondent for the Boston Globe. We're talking tonight about the U.S. transfer of sovereignty to Iraq. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the U.S. handover today, about what it means for Iraqis and their future. Are you an Iraqi American living in the United States? Are you celebrating the news of the handover or reflecting on difficult work to be done in the months ahead? Do you believe it brings new hope for a better Iraq? And is the interim Iraqi government up to the challenge? Join the conversation at 0800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio, Barry Posen, Professor of Political Science at MIT. Welcome to you. Also joining us from Vienna, Austria, is Fawaz Gerges, Professor of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. And thank you, Professor, for being with us in what is the early hours of the morning with you. Professor Posen, President Bush today spoke of the Iraqi people getting their country back. Is it accurate to say that?
I think it's accurate in a legal sense, but I think there's lots of practical questions that are going to intervene. And, you know, the first one that's obvious is that there's at least 150,000 foreign troops in the country. Those troops have been carrying out fairly energetic and wide-scale military operations. Not necessarily a lot of firepower every day, but lots of activity. The general that we're sending out to command that force, the new general, has promised to continue to take some kind of a forward posture, which means that they're still going to be busy. This is an unusual situation for any sovereign country, and it's going to be something that the new government is going to have to deal with in terms of the impressions of their own people.
Who's going to be writing the checks now?
Well, this is another question. The resources that are available to the government are coming basically from, I guess, three pools. One is the United States, which I think is the biggest donor now. Second is oil money, which is going to be overseen to some extent by an outside force, and then other aid. So there's lots of folks who have resources that the new government needs that they're going to have to satisfy. That's going to be another source of outside influence. Outsiders are still sitting on the ports and the airports and providing security there, which means going in and out of Iraq doesn't necessarily produce an encounter with an Iraqi. It produces an encounter with somebody else. So on many pragmatic questions, Iraqis are not going to experience day-to-day life the way a country normally would if it were in full control of its affairs.
Fawaz Gerges, do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, absolutely. He is very correct. Not only is the United States has about 135,000 soldiers in the country, the United States will have one of the largest embassies in the world, almost 3,000 Americans. Basically running the affairs of Iraq. And yes, I think the ceremony took place today, but let's remember that the interim Iraqi government is not a sovereign government, and yes, of course, it has some elements of legitimacy because, of course, of the involvement of the United Nations and the legitimacy bestowed on this government by the religious authorities. I think what we need to stress today, this is the beginning of a very difficult and complex and dangerous problem. And I think there are so many unknown variables, and it all depends on many unknown variables. This is why I think we need to stress it's the beginning of a very difficult process. We have to wait and see how the security situation evolves. I think the security situation, Julian, is highly volatile and precarious. And this is, of course, a cliche. I'm not saying anything creative. The fact that the ceremony itself was a low-key one tells you about how dangerous the security situation. And I think it seems to me that the armed insurgency has become deeply entrenched among various Iraqi communities. It's not just a question of terrorism. Of course, Zarqawi operates in Iraq. Of course, there are some foreign fighters in Iraq. But the truth is that the armed insurgency has taken root within certain Iraqi communities. And the question is, how would you deal with this particular insurgency? How would you integrate Iraqi communities into the political process? How do you legitimize the political process? I think they are these are very difficult questions. It remains to be seen if the new Iraqi interim government will be able to deliver the goods to Iraqis.
Professor Rosen, we heard Dr. Muwaffaq al-Rubai, the National Security Advisor of the interim government, saying earlier that his administration would be more preemptive with the insurgency. What can we expect?
It's hard to know what you could expect. I mean, the Americans, I think, have tried to be as preemptive as they could be, and you can only preempt on the basis of intelligence. I think the question that was raised in the second interview about whether the intelligence will improve, I think, is the key question. And that really relates to the legitimacy and competence in the new regime. So these things are all interconnected. And all kinds of counterinsurgency operations, intelligence is the key. And it's not going to do them any good to run up and down the country with police forces, competent or incompetent, if they don't know who they're chasing. So I think that's the $64 question. And I think the point that was just made about how deeply entrenched the insurgency is, I think, is a critical point. It's one that the U.S. government has really not wanted to admit all along the way. I think the U.S. government has consistently underestimated the size, the competence, the commitment and lethality of the insurgency that it faces.
Professor Jedges, we heard Dr. Rubai talk in terms of security being a priority, but it was only one of a list of four. He also mentioned the economy, elections, infrastructure, all these that the new administration had to deliver on. Is security, though, the key?
Absolutely. And I think what we need to remember here, Julian, let's remember that almost unemployment is almost 65% throughout Iraq today. The economic situation is very serious. But at the end of the day, I mean, most Iraqis, the overwhelming majority of Iraqis, would like to have security. The key question is security, security, security. I think economic and political progress in Iraq competes with chaos. And this is the question, how do you, get the situation under control? And I think I would argue here that I think the official record, at least our official narrative in Washington, has been is that, of course, we will witness a spike in attacks before the end of June. I would argue myself, and I hope I am wrong, that the security situation will likely deteriorate much worse after the end of June, in particular in the next few months, because, again, I come back to the big question. The big question is that what we are witnessing in Iraq are not basically the terrible, awful, evil deeds. A few terrorists like Zarqawi, and they are on the scene. What we are witnessing in Iraq basically is, I think, the deterioration of security on wide scale. I would argue because of the insurgency has become deeply entrenched in the country. I think we're likely to witness much more, increase in the level and quantity of attacks. And this is why I come back to the question of legitimacy. How do you legitimize the political process? How do you convince Iraqis that their government is basically genuine? How do you convince Iraqis that they have a stake in the future? You do it by doing the following. First, I think, Rabai stressed earlier, I think elections must be held as soon as possible to legitimize the political process and to convince Iraqis that the government is genuine. Secondly, I think you need to hold a conference of national reconciliation to basically bring all Iraqi communities into the political scene. Let's remember that the Sunni community, the Sunni Arab community, which represents about 20% of the population, feels victimized and punished for the crimes committed by one of its members, Saddam Hussein. And thirdly, I think you need to be as inclusive as possible, that is to bring, again, all the communities into the political process. And I think the departure of Mr. Paul Bremer served this particular process. I think he was perceived as a dictator. Even Mr. Al-Akhdar Brahimi, the UN envoy, referred to Mr. Bremer as a dictator, in the sense I think he committed some major mistakes in the process trying to help Iraqis rebuild their country.
We're talking tonight about the U.S. transfer of sovereignty to Iraq. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. And let's take a call from Charlie in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Charlie, what did you want to say?
No, thank you very much. Both of your conversants there have stressed the role of the insurgency. And I wonder whether there's some explanation for why there is an insurgency. Is this a conflict among interest groups, Kurds, Sunnis, Shiite, or is this based more in the resistance to the American occupation? And if it's the latter, does that mean it will tend to disappear when we exit the battlefield?
Professor Pezin?
Unfortunately, I think it's a little bit of both. we don't really have that good an understanding, I think, of the insurgents and who they are. You hear lots of different things, and it seems to me that there's three or four different groups. Some of them might fight each other tomorrow, but they might be more interested in fighting the Americas today. I think there's a group that's basically old Baathist, old regime. I think there's a group that's essentially fundamentalist Islamic. There was a Shiite urban group around this Muqtadir Sadr person, and there seems to be some group or network that has a kind of local, national, patriotic, religious kind of quality to it. And some of those groups might be less inclined to fight, depending on how the new government performs. Others of those groups will probably never stop fighting. My guess is that the more fundamentalist group will simply never stop fighting until they achieve or what they would like to achieve, which is a fundamentalist state, which I don't think most Iraqis want.
Let's hear from David in Madison, Wisconsin, and he's got similar concerns, I think, about ethnic and religious rivalries in Iraq. David?
Yes. My question is, I think it's probably going to be an issue that will probably rear its ugly head much sooner than we'd all hope it would, but because we have three different groups, Sunnis, Shias, and the Kurds, who have three distinctly different agendas with regard to the direction that Iraq goes into. And the situation I'm most concerned with is the Kurds, because they've enjoyed the greatest amount of sovereignty for the lengthiest period of time. Things have changed today for them. And I'm just curious if, certainly, Julian, you've probably spoken to some of the journalists on the ground there. What do the Kurds think?
Well, the Kurds, certainly from my own experience, are extremely apprehensive about the way things are unfolding in Iraq. But let's get a more expert opinion, perhaps, from Fawaz Jerges. And could it just be that the Coalition Provisional Authority has kept the lid on a lot of these ethnic and religious rivalries, and that with their departure, with the formal end of the U.S. occupation, they could come bubbling to the surface?
I think this is a very important question here. I think for our American audience, what we need to understand is that Iraqis are deeply divided over the future direction of that country. I think this is the reality of Iraq today. That is, Iraqis are deeply divided over what kind of political system they would like to have, or what kind of political, at least, direction that country would like to at least pursue. And I think there is, again, a potential that Iraq could descend into chaos and civil strife. And I think the insurgency itself is basically plays a decisive factor in creating alarm among Iraqis. And at the end of the day, not only we have, I mean, Iraqi communities are deeply divided among themselves, but there are also divisions and tensions and the contradictions within various Iraqis themselves. I think the Shiite community is divided along political, ideological, and religious lines. So is the Sunni community. And, of course, in fact, of all the Iraqi communities, it seems to me that the Kurds are at least united, more united than the Sunnis and the Shiites. But the fact is that Iraqi communities are deeply divided over the political future of their country, and this is a highly dangerous, at least, prospect for Iraq.
David, does that in part answer your question?
Yes, it does, and I completely concur with the guest's opinion. I think probably the Kurds have the greatest to lose in this current situation, and it just seems that, you know, this has just been passed off without addressing what I think is probably the most important issue. Thank you very much.
Professor Posen, do you think there was a sense in which the Coalition Provisional Authority played a mediating role, and that with the formal end of the occupation, that there is nobody to fulfill that function any longer?
I don't think it's fair to say that there's nobody to fulfill that function any longer, because of the discussion we had earlier, which is that the Americans are not really gone. The rest of the international community participating in erratic ways is not really gone. And we have a powerful interest in there not being a civil war in that country. So for as long as the American forces stay, for as long as this embassy continues to be the largest in the world.
You see Ambassador Negroponte then performing the same kind of role as Paul Bremer has?
With, we hope, a more deft touch. As was said earlier, I mean, Iraqis are fearful that they would fall into a civil war with each other. And I think many Iraqis know this would be a terrible thing, even as many Iraqis know that they have deeply conflicting interests with the others. So there is some political maneuver room there, particularly given that the Americans are holding so many of the hard power cards. But that doesn't protect Iraq against a civil war ultimately. I mean, these groups, I think, do have very different views. The Kurds would like a very weak Iraqi central government. I think the Shia would like a strong central government that they controlled. And the Sunni probably regret the passing of a strong central government that they once controlled, which they'd like to have back. And these are deeply conflicting objectives, which could, under the right circumstances, I think, produce a civil war.
Professor Jodes, do you see the dynamic within Iraqi society having changed with this symbolic handover of power today?
I think it's a very important dynamic, Julian, and this is why I said I think symbolism matters deeply in politics. But the big question on the table is the following. Will this particular handover of power today convince Iraqis that their government basically is beginning to call the shots? And the truth is, at the end of the day, when you have 135,000 troops in the country, when you have the largest embassy in the world in the country, when most Iraqis believe that the coalition forces, almost just 2%, Julian, now, of Iraqis believe that the coalition forces are liberators as opposed to occupiers. 2%, and according to the latest survey done by the coalition forces themselves, this tells you about the depth and level of distrust, of mistrust of Iraqis of the American forces. And since the insurgency is likely to continue in the next few months, and since American forces are going to be engaged in very aggressive tactics in order to put down the insurgency, there is again a real potential that, in fact, Iraqis will continue to perceive the coalition forces as occupiers, as opposed to liberators. And, in fact, the new emerging Iraqi governments might or could basically get entangled in some serious situation with the American forces. And this is why, I mean, I think holding elections as soon as possible is really crucial. It's crucial not just in terms of symbolism, but also in terms of legitimizing the political process and convincing Iraqis that this is a sovereign, legitimate government, and then finally they have to seize the initiative and take charge of their destiny. I think we have to wait and see how the security situation evolves in the next few months. My own instinct, Julian, I am extremely pessimistic about the situation, because it seems to me everything that we have seen tells me that the insurgency is much more dangerous than the Bush administration has been willing to tell us in the last few weeks.
Let's develop that a little bit further later. Fawaz Jerjes, do stay with us, and you too, Barry Posen. We're talking about the surprise U.S. handover of sovereignty in Iraq 2 days ahead of schedule. Do you see a more stable Iraq emerging with the interim Iraqi government in control of the country? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Julian Marshall. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. A new Iraqi flag now flies over the former American occupation headquarters in Baghdad, and interim Prime Minister Alawi and his cabinet officially run the fledgling democracy. What's the significance of today's handover in Iraq? Is this true democracy or a failed American experiment in the Middle East? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio, Barry Posen, Professor of Political Science at MIT. Also joining us from Vienna, Austria, Fawaz Jerjes, Professor of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College. Professor Jerjes, is Iraq a democratic experiment, do you think, for the rest of the Middle East?
Well, I think, Julian, let's remember that the question of democracy was really introduced late, I think, at in the stage of the game by the Bush administration. I think we know, we understand that the Bush administration decided to invade and occupy Iraq not in order to introduce Jeffersonian democracy into the heartland of the Arab world, but as he suggested, in order to destroy a horrible regime which possessed non-conventional weapons and which had links with Al-Qaeda and had, of course, the administration insinuated that the Ba'athist regimes had some links or even some connections to the 9/11 bombings of the United States.
But there is now a very specific timetable for returning the country to democracy, and the various milestones are being passed.
Julian, at the end of the day, I mean, as historians and political scientists and social scientists, we understand that democracy is not really a gimmick. There is no magical wand to really somehow bring democracy into a particular country or to export democracy into a particular country. You need the infrastructures, you need the productive sector, you need the middle class, you need the institutions, and so on and so forth. And this is a highly complex and difficult process. Let's hope that Iraqis soon will take charge of their destiny, will begin the difficult and painful and complex process of creating and consolidating the institutions necessary to bring about a democratic process. But in fact, the big point is the following. Regardless of what you think of whether democracy is possible or not, and I believe that Iraqis are capable of basically creating the institutions necessary to institute democracy. I think the American agenda, the American political project, American broader objectives in the Middle East have been damaged considerably as a result of the invasion of Iraq and the subsequent developments in the country in the last few months. And in fact, if the United States is truly genuine and serious about advancing the democratic project in Iraq, that particular project has been considerably damaged as a result of the Bush administration's policies in Iraq and beyond.
Okay.
And the truth is, the invasion and the occupation of Iraq appear to have produced the opposite results from their intended consequences, that is, to introduce and advance and promote the democratic project in the broader Middle East.
Professor Persson, that was the past. We're now looking towards the future. We're now approaching the first day of the handover. Is Iraq not readying itself for democracy?
Well, I mean, you've started a complicated process here, and it's an experiment. If I had set out to try and choose a place in the Middle East, Persian Gulf area to try and create a democracy as a model for others, I'm not sure I would have picked Iraq, a country that's been under a repressive dictator for a great many years, that's been ruined by sanctions, that's lost all these wars, that's divided among three groups.
Iraq is unsuited for democracy.
I'm not saying it's unsuited for democracy. I'm just saying if I were choosing an experiment to try and make a point, I would pick an easier one. Let's look at the situation in Bosnia, where they had a civil war, which is a little different from the situation we're in. But this was a divided society, and the war was wound up in 95, 96, and we're still there. And there's no emergent multi-ethnic democracy in Bosnia, and no one thinks there is going to be one anytime soon. I mean, these are very difficult situations in which to produce that kind of result. So, you know, we all hope that this is going to work, or that it's at least going to produce some kind of stable government. But there are big, big issues to be resolved here, and you know, it's going to require a terrific amount of ultimately goodwill and trust, and it's not clear where that's going to come from.
In the space of just a couple of years, Fawaz Gerges, Iraqis have known tyranny, they've known anarchy. Is there not now light at the end of the tunnel?
I think there is a light at the end of the tunnel. I think Iraqis of all Arabs and Muslims, as Barry mentioned earlier, have suffered or suffered the most. Iraq lived under dictatorships since 1958. 1958 was the date where the military came to power and massacred the members of the monarchy. Saddam Hussein and the Ba'athist regimes played on ethnic and religious divisions in the country. And I think as a result of their suffering, as a result of their witnessing horrible deeds in the countries, and I think Iraqis are terribly looking forward to the future. But the question is, it's a very dangerous process. Iraqis are deeply divided over the future direction of their country. Iraqis don't really have much trust left. Civil society is deeply fragmented. Okay. And this is why this is a highly difficult and dangerous process.
Let's just take a quick call from Arvin in Skenderian, Massachusetts. And he wants to ask a question, in fact, which I was about to ask myself. Arvin.
Yeah, it's Armin, actually, A-R-M-E-N.
Okay.
My question is the gentleman, the professor from Austria, he seems to always be putting the negative spin of the what's happening in Iraq. I think it is about time to give the Iraqis a chance to see if this experiment, the democratic experiment, is going to work for them. And maybe that will be the nucleus for democratic society in the Middle East.
Fawaz Jajez, the briefest of replies, please.
Yes, absolutely. I think, unfortunately, we have been, some of us have been negative, because I think we know a bit about Iraqi history. We know about the divisions and tensions in the country. We know about the level of depth of mistrust. But again, as I said, Iraqis are capable of creating the institutions necessary to institute democracy. Let's hope that Iraqis seize the initiative and take charge of their political destiny.
Professor Posen?
Yeah, I think, I mean, people are worried, and they should be worried. But, I mean, no one should confuse, you know, worry and concern with a hope that it fails. I mean, I think everyone hopes that it succeeds, but it's just bound to be a very difficult process. And I think it's not just Iraqis who have to understand how hard this is going to be. The outsiders who have set this objective for themselves have to understand the magnitude of the commitment that's been taken on. And this was the one thing the Bush administration did not understand when they started this business.
Professor Posen, many thanks for being with us. Barry Posen, Professor of Political Science at MIT. And our thanks to you too, Fawaz Jajez, Professor of International Affairs and Middle Eastern Studies at Sarah Lawrence College, speaking to us from Vienna, Austria, where it is the early hours of the morning. Many thanks to you too, Professor Jajez. Continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, the Supreme Court hands down key decisions on enemy competence and civil liberties. This is On Point. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that U.S. detainees held as enemy combatants can have access to American courts to challenge their detentions. The three cases under consideration were Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, Rumsfeld versus Padilla, and Russell versus Bush, named for the Guantanamo Bay detainee Shafiq Russell. The decisions were a setback for the Bush administration and its approach to fighting terrorism. Dahlia Lithwick covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com and joins us now. Tell us briefly these rulings, about these three rulings by the Supreme Court.
Well, the first one is probably the most shocking, and that was the Guantanamo case. That was Rasul. That was a 6-3 decision by the Supreme Court. Essentially, the question for the court was, does the United States have jurisdiction to hear habeas corpus complaints from a place that is not in the United States? Habeas corpus is simply a legal action that says, I want to contest the conditions of my detention. I don't accept that I should be detained. Amazingly, six of the nine justices of the Supreme Court agreed that even though Guantanamo Bay is not effectively really under the ultimate sovereignty of the United States, nevertheless, detainees who are not American citizens being held at Guantanamo do have a right to due process, to habeas corpus relief in American courts. The two other cases involved similar issues but slightly harder questions, because we were talking about Jose Padilla and Yasser Essam Hamdi, both of whom are U.S. citizens. Not only U.S. citizens, but also held in the United States. They've been locked up in Navy brigs and called enemy combatants for almost 2 years. One of the cases, Padilla, was a sort of spike back to the lower courts. The court essentially made it go away on a jurisdictional issue. They said that in his habeas petition, Padilla simply named the wrong jailer and has to go back and file his petition in South Carolina, not in New York. Hamdi was the real shocker, though. Hamdi, essentially 6-3, although a lot of people are counting it 8-1, the Supreme Court got to the real heart of the matter, and they said that the president's claim that the executive can simply call someone an enemy combatant, lock them up, and throw away the key without any judicial scrutiny is wrong. Essentially, the court said, on the one hand, yes, the president is authorized to name people enemy combatants, but absolutely no, he is not authorized to limit judicial review.
I mean, the American Civil Liberties Union has called the rulings historic. I mean, how large a blow are they for the Bush administration?
One of the most interesting things that happened today was that both sides are claiming terrific victory. The early headlines in these cases suggested that the Bush administration had actually prevailed in these cases. It seemed initially as though it wasn't a big deal because it seemed as though the court was saying to the Bush administration, you have what you sought. You have the right to call people enemy combatants. But I think as you sort of look through the opinions and really see, particularly in that Hamdi case, that 8 out of 9 justices said, absolutely not. The court cannot be written out of the equation, that in this sort of fundamental question of balancing executive power versus judicial versus congressional power, in the most profound way and in the most profound assessment of those questions since really 1952 when President Truman tried to seize the steel mills, the courts have not been written out of the equation. I think that that truly is historic. And the ripple effect goes to so many questions of you know, administration policy. As we know, in the last couple of months, so many times we've heard resonating through the discussion, the administration doesn't need to be checked. The administration doesn't need to abide by the law. The administration, acting in wartime, has some sort of extraordinary power to act without conferring with the other branches. And I think this was such a fundamental response to that. It was essentially the court saying, at the end of the day, the final arbiter will not be the president. At the end of the day, the final arbiter will be the court.
You talk about a ripple effect. Can we expect now a rush of court cases by detainees?
Oh, absolutely. I think that there's no question. I mean, one of the things that's a little tricky in these cases is the court doesn't tell us exactly what that due process is going to look like. And so everybody's going to be fumbling to try to figure out what exactly it is that these detainees are entitled to. Are they entitled to counsel? Are they entitled to, the hearsay rules and the other rules that we would normally afford them? But absolutely, there is no question. We have now opened the door. The detainees will get to choose their forum, in fact, in the United States. You can expect a lot of lawsuits filed in California and very, very few filed in Virginia.
And on what basis can we expect challenges, very briefly?
Well, I think that probably each and every one of these detainees is going to essentially make the argument that Hamdi made, which is, I was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm a relief worker. I happened to be passing through. I turned left when I should have turned right. Those sorts of claims. And in some sense, even though many of them probably were terrorists, many of them probably did fight with the Taliban and lift arms against the United States, it's important that all of these detainees have never had a day in court, that these were battlefield determinations made immediately during a war, and they've never had subsequent due process. And so I think that even if just, you know, 3 or 4 of them truly were relief workers in the wrong place at the wrong time, this is a good, good decision to reaffirm that they have a moment in court.
Dahlia Lithwick co-covers the Supreme Court for Slate.com. Many thanks. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.